Interface. Not the same questions, not the same answers.
Hello, I'm Brad Johnson, and welcome to Interface, a weekly examination of Christian perspectives on theology, philosophy, ethics, and culture with Adam Ayers, the pastor of Disciples Church in Costa Mesa, California, and the founder of the Stoa Foundation. And we are fortunate to have in the studio with us once again today our engineer Chris Holawaty, who normally sits on the other side of the glass, but today has joined us behind the mic once again. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Today on the program, this was a topic actually that Chris had suggested. Frequently the values of our society don't necessarily hold up when compared to biblical values, you know, the values that we find in Scripture, the things that God loves and God hates. But frequently we find that the values of our society creep into the church. And today we wanted to talk about materialism. And Chris, what were the perspectives that you had that you wanted to bring to the show today?
Actually, it kind of came clear to me as we were recording the last show, as we were talking about suffering. Something that Tom said last week was talking about how it's very easy to get sucked into the values of the world and how the world is constantly pushing its values, its messages, its perspectives onto us as believers. And as you guys were talking about suffering, I began to realize just how much or how easily a worldly mindset can creep into my own thinking. I'm currently getting paid a decent wage as a coordinator for all the music that this studio produces. And I make more money than I ever have in my life. And as a 28-year-old guy, it's kind of nice. I'm getting married. It's nice to make some money. Lately, I found myself thinking in terms of, okay, how am I going to provide? How am I going to take care of a family should that come? How am I going to take care of my wife? How am I going to, you know, provide all the things I'm supposed to provide? And in the last couple of years, it's become very clear to me that a lot of these things that are important, that seem important, financial security, having a home, are not necessarily biblical ideas. One of the ideas that is very prevalent in the church is the idea of being financially sound, not being in debt. There's that one passage, you know, have no debt other than love, which often gets interpreted now as being, you know, you should never owe money to anyone. That also gets translated into the idea of, well, you should be able to financially take care of yourself and of your family.
Plan for
your financial future. Make sure you have the right investments. Make sure that when you're 60, you're going to have a nice hoard of money to rely on so you won't be a burden to your kids. This is not necessarily a biblical idea.
It's really funny as you describe that scenario, providing, dare we even open up the catchphrase, stewardship.
Yeah.
I just hear Luke's notation that Jesus' ministry was supported by the wife of Chuza, Herod's steward, and many others. Interestingly enough, he notes the ladies who supported Jesus' ministry, which is quite significant there, and that Jesus himself had no place to lay his head, called men away from their families and away from their jobs in order to do this.
Right.
And then to be supported by these ladies' donations. We obviously know that Peter had a wife. Paul mentions it, you know, couldn't we lead around a wife as Peter does? And his mother-in-law was ill, who Christ raised out of the fever. So Peter was a man with responsibilities. And Jesus says, drop it all, come with me. Not very financially responsible. I can't help but think of the rich young ruler. If we're going to talk about stewardship, Christ says, okay, here's my idea of stewardship. And the funny thing is, we would say, what would be good stewardship? If we're going to be good pragmatists now, the thing to do would be to sell all your goods. Well, if you're going to take this scenario, sell your goods, put them in some sort of an endowment that will fund Jesus's ministry.
Right.
See? And make sure that that's well provided for. Instead, Jesus says, sell all your stuff, give it away. And come on, let's lead this crazy wild life, you know? Let's live a life of faith. That's Jesus's idea of stewardship. Jesus's idea of stewardship is the unrighteous servant who he commends for saying, well, he just dumped everything, gave it off at a loss, and his master commended him. And he says, well, then use your unrighteous mammon to buy righteousness. And he's not saying store it up. He's not saying provide an endowment for Christian ministries. He's saying dump the stuff and prepare eternal habitations for yourself.
Right. I mean, I was online a while back in a Christian chat room of all places, and the current catchphrase was the, you know, WWJD or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, what would Jesus do? And that has always just struck me as such a strange phrase. What would Jesus do? Well, let's ask, what did Jesus do? Mm-hmm. And so I began to chat with some folks, and I said, well, if we're going to do what Jesus did, then let's all be homeless. Mm-hmm. Let's give away everything. Let's wander around and pretty much insult and demean all the religious leaders of our time and get ourselves killed. Mm-hmm. And the response I got in the chat room was not really favorable. I mean, they really weren't amused. Mm-hmm. And I really had one guy just going off on me and saying, well, fine, if you think that's what you're supposed to do, go do it. You know, but I'm going to make sure I take care of myself, kind of a thing. And this was in a Christian chat room. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting that even today the things that Jesus taught still aren't popular with Christians. Mm-hmm. You know, and I mean, the things that Jesus said, if anyone asks of you, give it. If someone demands your coat, give him your shirt as well. I don't like those passages. They make me very uncomfortable. And, you know, I'm thinking about how do I, you know, it's so just taken for granted. You're supposed to take care of your family. You're supposed to take care of yourself.
The question arises very quickly, what is genuine provision for your family? Because we default to our American pragmatism. Well, provision for your family is to give them a house. And there's an interesting anecdote. One of the early church fathers, a man came to him who had made his living, strangely enough, in the Roman Empire black market. There's black market goods then, just as now. And this particular man came to this bishop and said, here's my dilemma. I've made my whole living really as a criminal, but I have to provide a roof over my head. I have to provide for my family. You know, I have all these commitments. My children have to eat and they have to be clothed. And the bishop responded, do they? Do you? And the question really there is, obviously brought to the fore, what is genuine provision for your family? Is it better to provide material goods for your family, or is it better to provide an example of genuine priorities? Because we as Christians would say the physical aspects do not matter. That's not what gives one a ground for peace. What gives one a ground for peace is the presence of the Lord and the presence of the resurrection, that God takes care of us. The lilies of the field, you know, they neither toil nor spin, yet God takes care of them. The sparrows, you know, one of the clearest commands of Christ over and over again, give no thought for the morrow, give no thought for the morrow. What does that say about mortgages? See, what does it say about financial planning? What does it say about 401ks? And, you know, you can just hear the ripples going out from this radio show. Oh my gosh, you're saying don't be responsible. No, I'm saying be responsible. Be responsible, live like Jesus said to live, which is give no thought for the morrow. That's how Jesus casts responsibility. Responsibility is primarily spiritual and moral and ethical and secondarily pragmatic. But when it comes down to it, is it more responsible to obey Christ when he says don't think about the future? Or is it more responsible to mitigate the words of Christ by our pragmatism and say, well, we can think about the future, honey, because it means that we'll be nice and safe. So do you gamble with your soul or do you gamble with your house? You tell me. See, which is very odd. Because, like, for example, the passage where it says, where Christ says, if somebody, you know, asks you for money, give it. And what's the almost universal response?
Well, they're going to use it for alcohol. They're going to use it for drugs or...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And never mind that Christ said, judge not lest you be judged, right? So here we have a situation. we'll say the person is going to use it for alcohol. They come to you and they say, can I have $5? Whatever, right? You at that point say, well, they're going to use it for alcohol. And disobeying God is a sin. And drinking alcohol is a sin, or using drugs is a disobedience. Therefore, I will not give them money. But you've disobeyed. So you don't want somebody else to sin, so you'll sin?
Oh, I don't want you to sin. I'll go ahead and sin. That way you don't buy alcohol, I'll disobey Jesus. Okay? So that you don't disobey the words of Christ. And, you know, as we know, Christ said, thou shalt not drink alcohol. But, you know, here, yeah. So that we anticipate someone else's sin, and to relieve them of the burden of that sin, we are willing to disobey that which we have been told to do, which is amazing. But in reality, it's more like we're greedy. You know, we don't want them to spend on alcohol. We want to spend it on cable TV, see, which, of course, is not our mood-changing element.
Yeah, we you know, yeah, so we compare the drug use with entertainment. Yeah.
Yeah. So I could use that $5 and go to a movie, you know, which is a mood altering experience. Tell me that's not a mood altering substance to which we're addicted. Entertainment, that's not a mood altering situation to which we're addicted.
Sure.
See? Buying, if we get in our cars because they have leather seats, we feel good, and because it's a nicer, faster, more aesthetically pleasing vehicle than someone else's. We feel good. We are mood elevated. We are personal and identity elevated. Tell me that's not an addiction. I have to have a bigger house. How much of your bed can you sleep on at once? How much of your house can you live in at once? I can only live in, 5'8" at once. You see, I can only take up so much air. How big of a house do you need? Well, for the kids. Think back to when you were a kid. Okay? A little cardboard box is a huge toy.
But it's an absolute repudiation to everything that is crammed down our throats. When you really step back, when you watch TV for an hour and begin to be just very critical of every advertisement that comes on and really watch it and say, what is it telling me to do? It's telling me to spend money on something that until I watched this commercial, I really didn't think that I needed. That same kind of a thing is push just overall in our values. We look around and look at what our neighbors have. We look at what the people around us have. And I mean, I remember the first week on the job here, I had a fellow coworker show me around to different people who work here to point out what kind of car they drove.
Mm.
And that, oh, this person, you know, they are of this position and they have this kind of a car. And someday you might be able to have a car like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept thinking, I don't even like cars. But so at the same time going, but yeah, there's something, you know, all of a sudden now I'm having this kind of a comparative standard put in front of me that says, okay, you're okay if you have this. That's the danger of materialism. What we're talking about is that it all of a sudden you start gathering all this stuff and garnering all these things and you begin to have the illusion of security.
They have sedan envy.
Sedan. It really, I think what it is that these words of Christ terrify us, because what he is saying is what he's always said: you lose this life to gain one. And I'd like to manage my life in such a way where I have just enough comfort to get me through this one to gain even greater comfort in the next one. You know, it's so insidious. But the danger of it being, and we talked about this, you guys talked about this last week, the purpose for suffering is to strip us of those things that we really don't need to discover what it is that we really do need. Mm-hmm. The purpose, I think, in what Christ teaches here about giving it away, about not hoarding up for yourself. Don't store up treasure on earth where moth and rust will destroy, but store up treasure in heaven. That whole mentality is, again, it's the same message of going, remember what's important.
Keep in mind that you are going to die. That's like the huge denial, isn't it? You know?
It is the big secret.
It's the big secret. Hey, you know, you're going to die. And don't be so morbid. Morbid, I'm being honest, you know? Nobody gets out of this life alive, right? But I think one of the things that you kind of gravitate toward that is very, very important for this discussion is that very few of the things that we buy or possess maintain their actual identity. The identity of a car is changed from something to transport you. Instead of that, it is something to make you a certain kind of a personality, to grant prestige, to grant aesthetic comfort, to grant joy. In the same way, clothes, they are not to protect us from the elements. They are to give us image. They are to give us pleasure. They are to give us a certain social standing. They are to give us a certain social voice. The identities of these items now have been changed. It is not a house. It is a statement. It is not a car. It is a self-fulfillment. You know, these are not clothes. These are rewards. And all the identities now have changed. These are not things which we are using to survive. Honestly, we get a little bit put out if we have to eat the same kind of food three times in a day. Huh? That means we're not eating for food, which is fuel to survive and keep the human body going. We're eating for pleasure. We're eating to develop our tastes, see? And in America, we have this huge overdevelopment of preference. And we place in these items identities other than are actually inherent in them. And we turn them into existential satisfactions. These are our fulfillments. Do we need a certain kind of car in order to survive? No, we really don't need a car in order to survive. Do we need a certain kind of house? But we want one with a good view and we want one with a big yard because we want to have an overdevelopment of preference. It's not that you don't have a place to sleep. It's that, well, we want the perfect place to sleep because that is fulfillment. And that will tell us that we have been good parents. And we're really not buying it because we need it. We're buying it because it is a symbol that we use to tell ourselves that we have done a good job. Okay? As such, we've changed its identity. The Christian stance is that Christ provides it for us either the thumbs up or the thumbs down on our life. Either he provides our existential fulfillment, our life's fulfillment, the actual experience of our lives, this existential aspect. Either he provides that or he doesn't provide that. If he does provide it, we don't need other identities. If he doesn't provide that, what are we doing as Christians? And so we really have to wrestle with, will I be an honest Christian who is fulfilled by my relationship with Christ and in my relationship with Christ, and as such, repudiate and reject all these other identities? Or will I still hold to these identities, truly idols, false gods, false fulfillments, and fall into the trap like Paul talks about wine, be not drunk with wine, wherein is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit? Tell me there's not dissipation in the car, the house, the boat, the charge card bills, all of these other things. Mm-hmm. Tell me it's not distraction to always be perseverating about our portfolios. See? When Christ himself says, don't be anxious about tomorrow. Oh, but I'm allowed to be anxious about tomorrow. I'm allowed to violate the commands of Christ because it will make me feel safe and be self-fulfilling, and I'll be a good parent somehow that way. Ooh. When Christ says, don't worry about tomorrow, don't worry about tomorrow. And don't say, I can disobey Christ because that makes me a good parent. Because if you're disobeying Christ, you are not providing for your children what is actually needed, which is a model of how to follow Christ and how to keep one's priorities in the right place.
I would say that my heart's desire is to be all for Christ, but I find myself wanting to be at ease, wanting to feel secure from a financial standpoint. Like you were saying, you know, Chris, about providing for your family. I feel like it's such a trap living in this culture, being, you know, caught up in the mainstream of it all. Day to day, I just find those influences creeping into my life, and it's so easy to lose perspective so quick on what Christ has called us to.
See, that's why Christ casts it as a faith issue. Do you have faith? Do you believe that God loves you? Do you have little faith, or do you have faith enough to walk in this? See, your God is that in whose presence you will relax, because that's in what you really trust. Mm-hmm. I will relax when the eye of God is on me, or I will relax when I have enough money. Okay? You know, ironically, our money says in God we trust, but in our religious lives most often, and I say this as the leader of a congregation, most often in the religious lives of congregations and Christians, though our money says in God we trust, our congregations and our religious structures say in money we trust. We won't put that ministry together until we have funding for it. What? That means in money we trust. Is this odd schizophrenia? As a pastor, okay, here I am. I'm supposed to be leading a congregation. And of course, there are those same pressures. Well, you know, in order to be grown up, in order to be secure as a congregation, you need to provide for your congregation a good house. You've got to have the parking lot. You've got to have all the right things. If you build it, they will come. You know, and the idea somehow that I am not a good pastor until I provide my congregation with their first home. You know, until we get the home with the best view, we are somehow not grown up. See, when are we going to be a real church? You know, it's like, wait a minute. Why is that same pressure placed for development programs, for these sorts of pragmatic things? The only pragmatist I can think of in the Bible, as far as the apostles, is Judas. He's the one who complains that there is this bad stewardship by that gal. She could have taken that money that was poured out from that alabaster jar of ointment. She could have used it to feed the poor. You know, well, that's a totally different question, but her wastage and irresponsibility with her resources then triggers Judas's criticism.
Jesus told a story about a man who built some new barns, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah, fool, hey, he calls him.
You know, I think of a funny story that happened a few years ago when I was working for a large corporation. I came in and talked to you for a few moments and said, you know, I feel really funny. Here I am working for this large corporation, and I'm caught up in this, you know, corporate life. And I started thinking about, well, what am I going to do in 5 years or in 10 years? You know, what do I say if somebody comes up to me and says, well, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Or where do you see yourself in 10 years? Well, I guess I'll just turn and say, oh, I don't know. I'm just trusting in the Lord. And Adam, you looked at me and you said, well, what's wrong with that? And sure enough, that very week, my boss came up to me and says, Brad, where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Really?
I said, well, you know, it's funny you should ask. And it was really a fun opportunity to put that into action.
But it's awkward being around unbelievers in a workplace when you don't share their ambitions, when the things that everyone around me is striving for are not the things I strive for. Advancement, position, money. These are not the things that motivate me as a believer. And so it's hard to have a frame of reference. Sometimes our conversations just die in the water because, you know, I'm just not interested. You know, we're talking about looking forward to doing this and doing that. And to me, you know, they ask me, well, what's your goal for your career? I don't have a goal for my career. I don't know what God's going to do next year. And the whole goal of financial security to me seems like such a joke. How can you possibly plan your financial future? I mean, just last week, the Dow market just dropped 500 points. And what troubles me is that sometimes in the church, when you begin to speak this way, everyone gets fidgety. We have gotten caught up in the church in the whole thing of stewardship, the whole thing of being financially smart. And I just feel like it's important that we remember what is really important. Mm-hmm. Jesus said, if you lose your life, you will find it. And if you seek to gain it, you'll only lose it in the end. Let it go, be extravagant. And I like that idea. I love that story about that woman in the alabaster perfume, because the whole thing is Jesus is going, yeah, be extravagant on me, on being wasteful. Mm-hmm. Give it away. And I just hope I can live this out now.
It's really interesting. Probably the most frequently asked question that I get from Christians when they find out I'm a minister is, one, how big is your congregation? Two, the second question invariably is it growing? And they look at me the oddest way when I say, oh, yeah, the people have much more character than they did last year. And they're like, no, is it growing? I'm like, yes, these people have matured in the image of Christ. It's an amazing thing. I am so proud of them. They have really turned to the task of being faithful. They say, no, but is it growing? I'm like, what other kind of growth do you mean? Again, the whole thing comes to mind of how do we assess what is good? How do we assess what is bad? What is more? What is less than? Is it more to be in the image of Christ, see? Or is it more to simply accumulate quantitatively? And when will we relax? Will we dissipate ourselves chasing after the same values under the guise of stewardship that is really self-fulfillment? Or will we relax when we have the presence of Christ in our lives? Will we be filled with the Holy Spirit, or will we be filled with things that dissipate us? because we really do have a responsibility of stewardship, but it is the stewardship of the image of God. It's the custodianship of His impress on our lives. It's the custodianship of those lives around us as parents and as leaders within the Christian community to best portray who is Jesus, and the custodianship of His character to pass that on to the kids, that the kids don't have to grow up with the same conflictedness that we have, that they, from the time they're young, can have it patterned to them. The material stuff is eh, but the matters of the heart, the matters of the soul, the matters of loyalty to Christ are paramount, and nothing can threaten those, no matter how practical it is.
Lots of food for thought. Adam and Chris, thank you so much for spending the time today to give us some perspective.
Chris, thanks for raising these questions.
Yeah,
kind of fun.
Kind of fun.
And thanks for being on this side of the glass with us once again. We'd also like to thank you for engineering the show week after week. Thanks to Media City Sound for helping to make Interface possible. And thanks to you for listening.